Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis, along with our co-host, Bullet Lewis. The November-December issue of Science of Mind has still been delayed, and hopefully we'll get it in time for some things for Thanksgiving, and if not that, for Christmas. And we'll have a lot of wonderful items to catch up on when we do receive it. Return to the September issue for some daily selections. Embrace a gratitude practice. Stormy or sunny days, glorious or lonely nights, I maintain an attitude of gratitude. If I insist on being pessimistic, there is always tomorrow. Today, I am blessed. Maya Angelou, letter to my daughter. Praise and thanksgiving are really attitudes of recognition. They are affirmations of the divine presence, the divine abundance, and the divine givingness. Ernest Holmes, 365 Science of Mind, page 479. And we're looking at gratitude since this is a month about thanksgiving and gratitude, gratefulness for all that we have and all that comes to us. Whether we are on calm or stormy seas, a dedicated gratitude practice is a shining star in our spiritual journey. When practiced daily, gratitude redirects our focus from what is going wrong to what is going right. It trains our hearts and minds to notice abundance instead of lack. It awakens our souls to the divine source of the countless gifts in our lives. Our gratitude practice reminds us of the magnificent blessings that surround us in the small moments of each day. Solid research reveals the extensive benefits of gratitude for our minds, bodies, and souls. Repeated studies make a clear connection between the daily practice of gratitude and the happiness, optimism, health, confidence, and enthusiasm we feel in our lives. A gratitude practice is linked to better sleep, a greater sense of wakefulness during the day, and an overall improvement in mental health. For the time it takes to count our blessings, there's a real-life return on our investment. I suggest you try this gratitude practice. Write down 3 to 5 things you're grateful for each day. It's that simple. Allow your intuition and your heart to guide you. In seasons of grief and challenge, when gratitude feels far away, noticing one small beautiful thing can be a star in your dark night. Like the little sprout making its way through a crack on the sidewalk, gratitude can plant new seeds of hope. Begin today by noticing what is good, loving, and kind. Recognize the beauty, the blessings, and the gifts, and give thanks. Affirmation: the more grateful I am, the more beauty I see. And this was from Mary Davis. And from the Daily Word, published by Unity, New Directions. I trust the calling of my heart and follow where it leads. If I'm not feeling fulfilled by the life I have been living, I remind myself I have the power through the divine within to go in a new direction. In the silence of prayer, I tap into my inner wisdom. I ask for direction, listening for the inner prompting of spirit to guide me, and I look for signs that may point me in the direction of my right path. I may wish to pursue a new career choice or embark upon a new course of learning. Perhaps I'm wondering how I might contribute to my community. Maybe I just want to explore new ways to have fun. No matter my new direction, I summon my courage and bravely move into my bright, fulfilling future. Fun. Having fun draws me closer to God, to spirit, to the universe. Having fun may not seem like a spiritual practice, but it is. Taking time to relax and laugh and play gives me joy. Feeling joy helps me find the presence of God, of spirit, of the universe within and all around me. Fun lifts me out of the seriousness and more mundane aspects of life. When I feel light and joyous, I'm more creative and everything seems possible. This is the lasting gift of fun, the reminder there's so much more to life than what my senses show me. I'm a spiritual being, blessed with the gifts of imagination, zeal, and love. Fun brings these gifts to life, empowering me to dream of a life beyond my senses, where anything is possible. And from Mark Nepo's The Book of Awakening, Having a Life You Want by Being Present to the Life You Have, Sustaining Wonder. In one atom are found all the elements of the earth. In one motion of the mind are found all the motions of existence. In one drop of water are found all the secrets of the endless oceans. In one aspect of you are found all the aspects of life. Khalil Gibran. As humans, we are relentlessly in cycle. The mind builds a shell to protect its turtle spirit, but the shell muffles the spirit, till outgrowing the shell, we devise ways to break it. We build the shell, then tear it down. We build it thinner, we tear it down. Yet only between constructions are we thoroughly touched. Only between encasements are we punctured by love. But we are not to be blamed. All of nature is conscripted to such a cycle. Trees grow moss, silver tarnishes. The mind is dulled by the growth of its conceptions. And likewise, a storm removes the moss, a scratch breaks through the tarnish, and crisis reveals the raw surface of the mind. Time builds and erodes, and we are transformed, yet the same. Wind gathers sand to a dune, and tide undermines the dune. It's how the early years pack us, and the later ones softly flood us without a sound. We have no choice but to withstand the film that constantly builds and to endure the erosion that inevitably follows. Of course, for humans, this dance of film and erosion is not merely physical. It affects our thinking, feeling, seeing, and being. How easily and repeatedly we dull and brighten. How easily we become chronic amnesiacs of spirit, drifting into observation and analysis when we stop participating and experiencing. Then we wake one day forgetting the feel of life while incredibly attuned to its silhouette. We can see it so clearly, each perplexity and nuance, yet why can't we feel it? In this way, the mind grows thoughts and words the way the planet grows trees, so much that we no longer see the heavens, and so we need to chop down what we think and say, and yes, silence is an axe. In truth, our aliveness depends on our ability to sustain wonder, to lengthen the moments we are truly uncovered, to be still and quiet till all the elements of the earth and all the secrets of the ocean stir the aspects of life waiting within us. The next time you walk outside, let the cold air wash over your closed eyes. Take a deep breath and let the air wash off the film of memory or thought you're struggling with. Feel your blood flush your face and open your eyes freshly. We turn now to the September-October issue of Science of Mind for Mark Waldman and Andrew Newberg's monthly column, Science and Spirituality. Power nappers are more creative. That's what a recent 2022 systematic review of 54 studies found when the researchers looked at the effects of taking short naps in the afternoon. Not only did their mood improve, but there were also mild to moderate improvements in memory, vigilance, speed of processing information, and other executive functions. And in another 2022 study, published in the prestigious journal Science Advances, researchers confirmed Thomas Edison's belief in taking power naps to assist in his creative inventiveness. Here's the secret. When you take a power nap, you need to wake up just when your mind begins to drift off into a daydream-like state, which happens in about 20 minutes. But if you sleep longer, say 60 to 90 minutes, you'll wake up groggier. When you're highly focused on your work, you activate your brain's central executive network, located in a small area just above your eyes. And when it gets exhausted, having used up all of the neurochemicals needed to keep your mind focused on what you're doing, the imagination center of your brain, the default network, takes over. Your mind begins to wander off into a daydreaming state, and this is when you literally dream up creative solutions to problems you face. In other words, to maintain optimal neurological and psychological balance, your brain needs to rapidly shift back and forth between your executive and default networks. These new findings challenge our traditional education system because they suggest that all of us, especially children in school, should take daydreaming breaks once or twice an hour. Instead, we've been told to keep our eye on the ball and to work as long as possible to accomplish as much work as possible. Unfortunately, this leads to burnout at the end of the day, which in turn disrupts the brain's normal sleep patterns. Experiment with taking a power nap daily, especially when you feel tired during work. Set a timer for 10 to 20 minutes. Any longer will leave you extra drowsy when you awake. You don't have to fall asleep. Just lie down and allow your mind to wander wherever it wants to go. Notice how different thoughts and feelings constantly flow through your mind. When the timer goes off, give yourself a minute to bring your attention back to the present moment, then ask your intuition what it would like to focus on for the next hour. You can even ask it for a creative solution to any problem you wrestle with. Many people just can't or won't take time to interrupt their work for 10 or 20 minutes. So here are two simple solutions that grew out of our brain scan research. Take a daydreaming break for 1 to 3 minutes every hour. Set a mindfulness clock to ring every 40 to 60 minutes on your cell phone and computer. When you hear the bell, lean back in your chair and deliberately allow your mind to wander off in any direction. You can add a stress-reducing mantra to take you into a deeply relaxed state by repeating a value word like peace, love, om, or God. And yes, there are many studies showing that most forms of relaxed meditation will improve both your sleep and performance at work. However, you might need to set a timer for 3 minutes in case you drift off. When finished, open your eyes and do 3 mindful yawns to help you wake up and focus on work by slowing down the daydreaming activity in your default network. Try it right now. Just close your eyes and do several real or fake yawns. After each one, you'll notice you're more relaxed and attentive to the world around you. Try 10 seconds of mindfulness 2 or 3 times each hour. This strategy can be even more powerful than the daydreaming break. Set your mindfulness clock to ring every 20 to 30 seconds, and when you hear it, just close your eyes and do 1 mindful yawn, 1 slow stretch, or focus on an inner value word that gives your life meaning and purpose. Then throw yourself back into work. As an alternative, you can take 30 to 60 seconds and simply observe the constantly changing thoughts and feelings floating through the background of your mind. This, too, will bring your brain networks back into balance. We turn now to the November-December issue of Spirituality and Health, a Unity publication, and an article by Stephen Kiesling, How to Live a Lifetime, an Earth Indigenous Elder Story of Immortality and Longevity. My immortality story begins a few days after Christmas, 1978, in my junior year at Yale. It was dawn in the Stone Stadium at Olympia in Greece, where I sprinted the length of the infield and decided along the way that I would become an Olympian and write a book about it. So powerful was that story that it worked. At age 21, I became a 1980 U.S. Olympic oarsman, immortal in one of the most physically demanding sports, and author of The Shell Game. Since then, rowing has remained my yoga, my meditation, my breathwork, my satsang. Rowing is a disciplined practice. You show up for the crew, on time, or you get on your rowing machine. The goal is excellence, fluidity, concentration, complete relaxation of every muscle that isn't working at full capacity. The rules are strict and fair even when the conditions are not. Enlightenment is the effortless unity of as many as 8 bodies exceeding the capacity of each individual in the pure joy of speed over water. Over time, you become a connoisseur of embodiment. Nowadays, there are so many clubs and camps and, of course, rowing machines that one can learn to row at any age. Over decades, I have won age group world championships, and at 49, I competed in the 2008 Olympic trials. I kept racing past 60 until I learned my heart was in constant atrial fibrillation, and I decided to quit competing. So, I have stories related to being maximally alive over a long period of time. My plan here is to revisit some old stories and perhaps learn something new. It's another installment of what I call an Earth Indigenous Elder Story, the attempt to recount one's hero's journey from the beginning of time. A girl's superhuman strength. Before I was an oarsman, I was a high school football player and student body president, and so found myself on the school stage assisting a hypnotist during a performance. As his grand finale, he convinced a slender freshman that she was as strong as steel, and then a classmate and I lifted her up and placed her feet on one stool and her head on another. She didn't bend. Then the hypnotist stepped up onto her midsection, and still she didn't bend. I was so amazed by her strength that after the show, I put myself in the same position between the stools and asked a friend to stand on my belly, and I collapsed. When I made the Olympic team, I tried the experiment again, and still I collapsed. I don't doubt that if I had really needed to become that stiff, if my child's life depended on it, for example, I could have done it. But the simple fact is that a trained Olympian tried and failed to do what a slender girl did without trying, without even knowing or remembering what she did. Had the hypnotist stood on her much longer, she would have been badly broken. That almost superhuman burst of strength seems part of the myriad survival systems that we typically can't access through normal consciousness. I now believe such evolved survival systems are not necessarily about our own survival. We are, after all, expressions of a chain of DNA that has remained unbroken through countless forms of life over billions of years. Ultimately, it seems, my life is not about me, but the unfolding of a larger story. The Half-Hour Olympian. More questions about extreme performance and not breaking came front and center as I trained for the 1984 Olympic trials. My problem was that I loved my job as fitness editor of American Health magazine, a more than 9-to-5 commitment, but I also wanted to compete at the Olympics in Los Angeles. My hypothesis was that typical athlete training regimens are like advertising budgets. At least half the effort is wasted. But which half? My quest became to discover the absolute minimum training time to become an Olympian, and then my friend Ned Frederick, Ph.D., head of research at Nike, came up with an answer. Just 30 to 40 minutes of interval training every other day. There was a catch. Each brief workout went to a pace and a place beyond where the body was meant to go. Consciously holding for minutes where the slender girl went for seconds, or the shame of not getting there. And it worked. Almost. My rowing partner and I got back to Olympic-level fitness remarkably fast, and we won the semifinals of the trials, but not, alas, the finals. Looking back, however, I don't recommend the regimen. It was horrible. But the real secret to the success of the program was in the rest, to not do any more work than those few minutes every other day. That rest was both to ensure the integrity of the work and to ensure our connective tissues stayed connected. When I failed to push to real failure in a workout, the time off felt worse because the effort seemed for nothing. Looking back at those lessons, probably the most useful thing I learned, what kept me essentially uninjured until the AFib, is the importance of recovery. In the years that my workouts included running, for example, I hardly ever ran 2 days in a row, even while training for a marathon. Why? Because I weigh more than 220 pounds and need 48 hours for my joints to recover. At 65, I still dance vigorously twice a week, and my joints are fine. Reel it in the years. A similar lesson is that if something starts to hurt, stop. Unless you have a seriously good reason, don't allow your body's survival systems, in this case our endogenous painkillers, endorphins, to mask the pain and enable you to damage yourself. So stop. Figure it out. Pain caught early can be fixed by stretching or poking into sore places or taking a brief rest. Otherwise, humans would never have survived. When you need more serious realignment, years before a joint replacement, find a healer who is slow and gentle and not building a repeat business around you. Meanwhile, figure out why you're out of alignment. My right hip taught me I needed a new truck with more leg room. Cheap desk chairs are really expensive. So are bad shoes. Ironically, the most dangerous activity for me is yoga. I try too hard and hurt myself. I then row to fix it. One of the first writers I ever edited at American Health was a man named John Jerome, who was becoming a competitive swimmer. He wrote that becoming an elder athlete is like being a fish on a line. By training hard, he could pull out the line from the reel and regain real freedom. But if he stopped training, or if he overdid it and had to recover, the line would be reeled back in. He could pull the line out again, but he never got quite as much line. I think that's right. The decades-long reeling in is gradual but inexorable. Meanwhile, the wonderful thing about competing in your age group is that races can feel as good as ever. My one remaining race is an 8-oared shell with old Olympians at the head of the Charles Regatta in Boston, where I feel 21 again. That's how aging should be. Objectively slower, but not subjectively worse. I also vividly remember racing then-current Olympians in 2008 when I was 49. Within 20 strokes, any illusions about actually restoring youth and immortality vanished. Another jarring awakening was at a press event at a wellness center in China where I was tested on a new Chinese medicine scanner and then whisked off to a cardiology lab. I felt fine, but that's when I learned of my AFib, an irregular heartbeat that turns out to be common among lifelong competitive rowers. My arrhythmia could have been fixed at least temporarily with shock therapy or surgery, but I feared the interventions as much as the arrhythmia, and I also felt my body was telling me something. A door was closing. Pushing so hard for so long got me to AFib, so I should stop. I felt sadness, but also relief. Then a local cardiologist convinced me to take beta blockers to slow my heart, and I found that I had to pause to gather myself before walking upstairs. I gained weight and began to reflect on what a great life I have had and being okay with it ending. 3 months later, I was told to stop the beta blocker before an echocardiogram, and I woke up born again. I threw the beta blockers away and went to the Sports Cardiology Center at Oregon Health Sciences University, where Bradley Petek, MD, explained to me that aging athletes don't easily tolerate the sense of heaviness or weariness beta blockers cause. Apparently, many aging Americans are fine with these medications because they're used to feeling heavy and weary as a result of a sedentary lifestyle. And the standard American diet, appropriately abbreviated SAD, of processed and fast foods, too much sugar, and high levels of sodium. Petek got me training again, AFib and all. He said I needed to add weights. Now I think of my mentor, T. George Harris, the World War II artillery scout who launched Psychology Today, American Health, and this magazine. A quintessential journalist, Harris was still smoking and drinking at age 57 when he hired me to help start American Health. Then he had a scare and gave up cigarettes and bourbon and put a stationary bike in front of his television. Each morning for the next 30 years, he pedaled for 30 to 40 minutes with only brief timeouts for heart attacks, strokes, and cancer. I came to believe he could pedal through anything. One of my few regrets is that I could never convince him to row. And from the same issue, we turn to a column by Jackie Fernandez, who's an award-winning filmmaker and writer who serves as senior minister at Unity Church of Overland Park. She's the founder of Folks with Faith, an LGBTQIA plus affinity group that gathers for spiritual discussion and healing from religious trauma. And that's Folks, F-O-L-X. Light up the darkness. Bring on the light. As we approach the end of 2024, many religions and cultures around the world celebrate the power of light. These celebrations include a variety of rituals such as lighting a tree, the candles of the menorah, lanterns or lamps, fireworks, and bonfires. Perhaps they're all playing at the revelation that each of us has within us an inextinguishable light. What if we marveled at what we see in the mirror with the same wonder with which we gaze at a grand fireworks display? Imagine asking yourself, as you look at your reflection with pure awe, "You're amazing. How did you do that?" Nestled in Chapter 3 of the Bhagavad Gita, the Hindu sacred scripture, is a reminder to marvel at your own unique light, to live your life true to your calling. Verse 35 reads, "It is better to do your own dharma, or calling, even if imperfectly, than it is to do someone else's dharma perfectly. Even imperfectly, it is better to follow your calling, your purpose, than to conform to someone else's idea of what that is." What a grand season to shine the light of gratitude on yourself for living out your purpose. Dharma includes universal principles like nonviolence, compassion, and justice, and your dharma fits your aptitudes and capabilities. More specifically, in the Hindu system, we each have swadharma, what is completely natural to you that benefits others. When you have the, that's what I was meant to do experience, it is likely related to your swadharma, your purpose. Yoga guru Sri Swami Satchidananda taught that to find your swadharma, ask yourself, how do I feel when doing certain things? Does something come easily? Is it natural for me or am I trying to imitate somebody? With these questions, explore what makes you feel like a fish in water, naturally being you, and in such a way that you are using your unique gifts and abilities to serve others. In this teaching, your swadharma may change over time because you will change over time. Avoid the trap of thinking you have a single purpose. You are vastly more complex, gifted, and blessed than that. And if you discover one purpose that stays with you, you will likely find upon closer inspection that your expression of it evolves over time. Trust your inner wisdom as you stay tuned in to the light that you are. In this season of celebrating light, consider the Festival of Lights called Diwali, one of the most widely celebrated festivals in Hinduism. Diwali signifies the victory of light over darkness, good over evil, and knowledge over ignorance. This year, Diwali, based on the Hindu lunar calendar and typically corresponding with the darkest night, new moon, begins on November 1st. Hindus will celebrate it over 5 days with puja, worship, to the goddess Lakshmi, And there will be fireworks, festive meals, lighting of oil lamps, and other rituals. Use this time to celebrate the light that you are and the many ways you shine your light. Consider your purpose, how you have overcome challenges in your life simply by being uniquely you. Just as the moon lights the night sky, you are a light as you share your gifts in community. In this season of gratitude for light and life, be sure to include your own willingness, determination, courage, and endurance for tuning into your Swadharma on your gratitude list. Even if it is only one small corner of the world, the darkness that surrenders to your light is by your nature overcome with love and life. We pause for a moment to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you're currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info and audio on /on demand. We return now to Rainn Wilson's Soul Boom, Why We Need a Spiritual Revolution. And we had started chapter 4, the notorious G-O-D, Be Still and Know That I Am God, Psalms 46:10. There's a secret one inside us. The planets and all the galaxies pass through his hands like beads. Kabir. We pick up with a section, The Case Against God. There are many reasons to not believe in a higher power, and I often hear them from various people I cross paths with. I was once shooting a movie in England, and the director, who we'll call Benedict, and I were visiting a church, and he turns to me and says, So, I understand you believe in God and all that? I responded in the affirmative. He then replied with, Well, I don't. I said, Oh, no? Really? And Benedict went on, No way. When I was a kid, I was dragged to church practically every day of the week. It wasn't enough to just go on Sunday. We had to go to daily mass. I was a choir boy and helped with the painfully long ceremonies and had to participate in all the god-awful church activities. It was just the worst. I hated it. So I just can't believe in God or any of that. I would agree there are some holes in that argument, but I'll let you decide. Another actor friend of mine once said to me as we were traveling in Spain on a movie shoot, Rainn, I'm sorry, but I can't believe you buy all of this God and religion garbage. I mean, look at all the hypocrisy. Look at all the evil that has been done in the name of this loving God. How can you possibly get with that? We pretty much covered the topic earlier. See, yo, atheists. A TV writer friend once said, Rainn, I just can't get with any religion that thinks that people are going to burn in hell for all eternity if they don't believe. I mean, how evil can you get? And I completely agree. Also covered. See, me and God. I have another friend named Chip. He also spoke to me about God and a higher power and relayed to me, When I was a kid, I was raised in the evangelical church and we were taught that if we accepted Jesus and were good people, that we would be showered with blessings and be saved and the good things would happen to us. Well, I did all that. And then my wife got breast cancer and had to get a lumpectomy. I just can't believe in a God where I did everything right, and then we're getting punished like this. This aligns with another friend of mine, Dave, who used to have quite a strong relationship to God, but has struggled with it after both his daughter and his wife developed brain tumors. His anger at God overwhelmed him, and he cut off any relationship he might have previously had. He was devastated, furious, and emotionally wounded by these horrific events. Understandable. How do we rectify a creator that would hand out so much personal tragedy? Grotesque, painful things happening to good and kind people. Heartbreaking. This brings us to one of the grandpappy arguments against a divine creator that I would like to take a little time to address on these pages. A digression on the nature of suffering. This long-standing argument against God was very effectively made by the actor, writer, atheist Stephen Fry. When asked in a now viral video, What if he was wrong about God's existence, and then he died and met God at the pearly gates? What would he say to him? Fry replied, and I quote, I'd say, bone cancer in children? What's that about? How dare you? How dare you create a world in which there is such misery that is not our fault? It's not right. It's utterly, utterly evil. Why should I respect a capricious, mean-minded, stupid God who creates a world that is so full of injustice and pain? That's what I would say. A very compelling argument indeed. This is a very complicated topic that Mr. Fry and the aforementioned Dave and Chip raise, all in their own fashion. With the limited space I have here, I will offer my perspective on this question, which is ultimately this. Why do bad things happen to good people? Why is there so much suffering in the world, especially inflicted on the innocent? We all experience pain and suffering. Death is a constant. Even childbirth is grotesquely painful, excruciating and miraculous all at the same time. Needless to say, sickness and illness are everywhere. Natural disasters abound. Accidents occur constantly. Hundreds of millions go to bed hungry each night. And as we grow older, there's the ever-increasing thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. My short response to this conundrum is threefold. Number one, where exactly does human responsibility end and God's hand begin? Imagine how much effort, research, and technology we've put into creating missiles, guns, warships, bombs, mines, drones, nuclear subs, fighter jets, and other countless horrific weapons of mass destruction. What if humanity spent the same amount of time, money, and energy working on actually healing and curing diseases, like cancer, that it puts into warfare? Perhaps we wouldn't even be dealing with cancer today, as well as so many other diseases. And tell me again, how is this God's fault and not our own doing? We have all the basic scientific tools we need to find treatments and cures for so many diseases that needlessly kill and cause untold pain to hundreds of millions. Yet we as a species have always chosen war, profit, and division over real humanitarian progress. Here's a footnote. Note, world military spending in 2021 was more than $2 trillion, with the United States making up more than a third of that. This is what $2 trillion looks like, and he's written it out. $1 trillion bills laid end to end would stretch out farther than the distance between Earth and the sun. And it's not just disease and bad health care that are negative byproducts of our misguided societal priorities. Agriculture, clean water, nutrition, distribution systems and transportation, mosquitoes, vaccines. We cause climate change, and then raise our fists and curse God when extreme weather events destroy our forests and cities. There is a list of entirely preventable ways in which innocent people suffer and die that we humans, especially the wealthiest among us, see the unjust economic extremes pandemic in Chapter 2, could easily be taking a far, far stronger stand and proactively treating, fixing, solving, healing. And the fact that we aren't should horrify and outrage every single one of us until we want to scream. But instead, we just putter along or lazily blame the big guy upstairs. So there's that. Number two, could suffering have an intangible upside? Let's look at suffering itself as a concept. Perhaps the Buddha was right in one of his central theses that life is suffering. I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. Suffering due to attachment is one of the Four Noble Truths and a central tenet of Buddhism. It should be noted that the Buddhist Pali Sanskrit term dukkha, which loosely translates to suffering, also means discontent, irritation, anxiety, frustration, and craving. In other words, negative emotions. The Buddhist path is to eventually free oneself of dukkha. More on that later. But what would the world look like if there were no pain, no suffering, no death, no stubbed toes, no broken bones or illnesses or natural disasters? This might be the universe that Stephen Fry longs for with an almighty God at the helm. What would that physical universe be like? How would it operate? Let's take a peek. A baby is born gently without any crying. The mother's vagina magically opens to allow the child out without any pain to her or the baby. And postpartum stitches, recovery and bleeding? None of that. Children mature without ever getting skinned knees, growing pains, or broken bones. No child ever gets their feelings hurt. Pain receptors only operate as pleasant internal warning systems. Accidentally, staple gun through your finger? Mild tingling only. There is zero disease and no genetic mutations. There are no earthquakes, tornadoes, or natural disasters. Death comes automatically at age 100 without any grief or discomfort to either the person passing or their friends and family. And most of all, no pain or death could ever possibly come to anyone innocent or younger than, say, 13 years of age. But as the great stages ever remind us, without ever experiencing pain or hurt or sadness, how would we then learn to appreciate joy or exhilaration or ecstasy? When you consider this as an option for our material plane, an option seemingly designed by Mr. Fry, it paints an absurd picture and a portrait of a hollow world. Number 3, is there a scientific case for suffering? Which brings me to my final response, which is, of course, science. A physical universe without pain, accident, disease, or death simply makes zero scientific sense. We are bodies composed of chains of vulnerable DNA. We live on a rock, hurtling through space with billions of other organisms, many of which, including viruses and bacteria and crocodiles, want to feed on us in various ways. Like all organic species, our bodies decay and deform. The list goes on and on. There's a false dichotomy that somehow the existence of God would mean that the laws of science would be abrogated and tossed out the window. Santa Claus, Father Odin, who is, after all, like the Bible says, all-loving, would make all our boo-boos go away. Or, like Chip brought up, this Sky Daddy would only allow bad people to get bone cancer, not the believers who hadn't done anything wrong, certainly not innocent babies. What a preposterous idea. The much larger question is, why is there suffering, and what purpose does it serve in this physical plane? If you accept my humble proposition that we are spiritual beings inhabiting material bodies for a few handfuls of decades, then maybe, just maybe, pain and suffering, both physical and emotional, might perhaps be connected to both our biological and our spiritual journeys. And once again, wisdom on the purpose of suffering can be found in the great spiritual and religious traditions. The Apostle Paul writes in Romans, "We also rejoice in our sufferings, because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope. And hope does not disappoint us, because God has poured out his love into our hearts by the Holy Spirit, whom he has given us." The Buddhist tradition doesn't speak much about the benefits of suffering per se, but more of the overcoming of suffering through non-attachment as our life's purpose and eventual path to spiritual enlightenment or nirvana. In the Buddhist tradition, suffering also allows us to increase our empathy for others that suffer, and this also helps us on our personal journey of compassion. Like a mother who protects her child, her only child, with her own life, one should cultivate a heart of unlimited love and compassion towards all living beings. Gautama Buddha. In Islam, one gives thanks to God, Allah, for the tests and pain we are given, and these things bring us closer to Him. Those who are able to see God's hand, will, and presence in affliction are the most spiritually evolved. The Holy Quran says, "Surely we will try you with something of fear and hunger, and loss of wealth and possessions, death, and the loss of fruits of your toil. Yet give glad tidings to those who are patient, who, when they are visited by an affliction, say, 'Surely we belong to God, and to Him we return.'" And finally, in the Baha'i tradition, tests and difficulties, similar to Paul's statement, are given to us for our own perfecting and maturation. The more difficulties one sees in the world, the more perfect one becomes. The more you plow and dig the ground, the more fertile it becomes. The more you cut the branches of a tree, the higher and stronger it grows. The more you put the gold in the fire, the purer it becomes. Therefore, the more sorrows one sees, the more perfect one becomes. Abdul Baha, Star of the West. Personally speaking, I have had tests in my life that I wasn't sure I would make it back from in one piece. But looking back on the torturous suffering I experienced, I emerged incredibly grateful. I'm sure there's some truth in this for all of us. Take a brief moment during your perusal of this paragraph to look back on your life and give a brief witness to the calamities you've survived and the growth, humility, wisdom, and perspective that you carried with you out the other side. Helen Keller, someone who endured unimaginable tests, said, "Life is full of suffering. It is also full of the overcoming of it." In summation, perhaps suffering, tests, and difficulties are actually the reason for this material existence, and finding joy while in the midst of them is our life's greatest and most important challenge. But let's get back to our story, why I am not an atheist. If I respect atheists so much, then why am I not one? You might be asking yourself. I will dodge that answer with a poem. To be alive, not just the carcass, but the spark. That's crudely put, but if we're not supposed to dance, why all this music? Gregory Orr. And I will back that artsy-ass poem up with a well-known science-based quote from Albert Einstein. The most beautiful and most profound experience is the sensation of the mystical. It is the sower of all true science. He to whom this emotion is a stranger, who can no longer wonder and stand wrapped in awe, is as good as dead. Now, bear with me. I know many atheists hate it when they simply and clearly ask for proof of this supernatural entity, and the theist immediately gets all cryptic and grandly poetic and uses that to deflect the question at hand. Let me start by saying that when in conversation with an atheist, I always ask about the God they don't believe in, and they usually, to a T, describe a God that I also don't believe in. I'll then get to respond with one of my favorite sentences. I don't believe in the God that you don't believe in. If one holds that the existence of a higher power must be based on a scientific standard of hard proof, an experiment in a laboratory, or an algorithm on a computer screen, can we all agree that we're screwed? The old show me verifiable and repeatable evidence that there is something other than matter, energy, and the laws of science is quite a task. Impossible? Perhaps. But not if one is open-minded enough to shift one's way of looking at and thinking about the topic. Not if you give yourself loving, imaginative permission to recontextualize your conception of the question itself. And by the way, what exactly would that hard proof look like? Let's say there was profound evidence of some inexplicable, never-before-seen mysterious force that preceded and even initiated slash guided the Big Bang. Well, then, of course, scientists would simply be looking for evidence of a scientific understanding of said force. As well they should, because that's how things work in this physical universe. But again, I believe this is a false dichotomy of God existing separately and apart from science and nature, or above science and nature. It's a dead-end street. Would the proof of a materialist, naturalist, physicalist needs be a verified photograph of a ginormous godlike face peering over the Andromeda galaxy and holding a lightning bolt while eating a churro with crumbs in his enormous beard? So, back to the question I've been dodging. Why am I not an atheist? Because, according to materialist doctrine, and there's a footnote here, I'm referring to the second dictionary definition of materialist, not a person who seeks consumerist comfort, but one who believes that existence is comprised entirely of the material. So why am I not an atheist? Because according to materialist doctrine, at the end of the day, this would mean that there is only stuff, things, specks, atoms, chunks, molecules, matter, plus a little dark matter thrown in. Energy flitting about in between, stuff that seemingly created itself, a universe that came into being on its own for some completely unknown and ultimately unknowable reason some 13.8 billion years ago. This leads me down the rabbit hole of, well, why is there anything at all? Why is there something? Why is there not just nothing? Buttloads and buttloads of stuff just popping into existence on its own for no reason simply makes no sense to me. It feels like its own kind of science-based superstition. I believe that matter, heat, energy, neutrons, protons, electrons, light, gravity, and time just burst forth from a single point because, well, it just did. That's just how it is. There is stuff. Period. Case closed. An entire universe of infinite complexity was born in a heartbeat because science. Really? Sorry. But it feels like a bit of a stretch. Plus, then it's all so meaningless. And in a world where we humans are wired for some unknown reason, thanks consciousness, to be incessantly searching, questing, longing for meaning, it just doesn't add up. Author and theologian David Bentley Hart makes an incredibly salient point. In the atheist worldview, there is a distinct and concrete way to measure success. Whoever can get by in their daily life and pretend not to notice that life is utterly meaningless. Wins. In a world without a divine spirit of the universe, you just have to plunk along day in and day out without noticing the inherent lack of meaning too often or letting the overall purposelessness of life bother you overly much. People who are good at that will do just fine and have a relatively happy life. That's not me. I lose in this scenario. I tried for several years, but I just couldn't accept being surrounded by all this awe-inspiringness that is completely devoid of purpose. Again, this experience of being alive is so wondrous and mysterious, isn't it? Can the force that through the green fuse drives the flower really just be narrowed down to nothing more than a series of accidental electrochemical impulses in our neurons? I simply can't abide being an atheist because of the reality of the great, glorious miracle of consciousness itself. The fully interactive, all-consuming, scintillating, transcendent, overwhelming 3D sense-around movie that's running nonstop in my body, heart, and head. I am having much, much more than just a biological experience as I motor along fretfully, being the consciousness of Rainn Wilson while writing this ridiculous book. And one of the centerpieces of this whole miraculous experience is love. Let's, again, look at love as an analogy connected to the conception of our old chum, the notorious G-O-D. If I were to say to someone who is deeply, madly in love, "Hey, love doesn't exist," they would say, "Nonsense. They are having a tangible experience of love, its power, its transcendence, and its many sumptuous and difficult nuances." I would then say to them, "Show me proof of this love of which you speak. Where is it? I want to see it replicated and demonstrated in a laboratory or in an equation or in an experiment or on a computer." I tell them, "Where is the formula or algorithm for said love?" Certainly, there are CT scans in which a region like the ventral tegmental area of our brain lights up when we look at a picture of someone we love, but that isn't proof that this singular, indescribable feeling exists. Those scans don't illuminate one single thing about that rapturous, transformative, emotional surge one gets when tearfully holding one's newborn child. And in all actuality, that exact same area of my brain that lights up when I see a picture of my wife or son would also probably light up if I saw a picture of a strawberry rhubarb pie or a kitten in a teensy-weensy cowboy hat. What if we needed actual proof that love exists, that it is glorious and all-consuming, drives our impulses, and is a condition, experience, and state of being toward which we can set our personal and collective North Star? One might, as a real-time hands-on sensory experiment, walk hand-in-hand with someone along the Seine in the rain, watch The Notebook, listen to Marvin Gaye, eat chocolate-dipped cherries, sniff roses, ride on a Ferris wheel while gazing longingly into another's eyes, and tenderly touching lips, but then ultimately feel nothing, nada, zip. I could then say, "See, there's no such thing as love." I mean, even the great musician Nina Simone once said, "You can't tell someone what it feels like to be in love." There is simply no way to scientifically prove that the most exquisite, gut-wrenching, and transcendental of all human experiences exists. And yet it is most certainly quite real and has driven a sizable number of human impulses for most of our recorded history. Hell, this idea is even in the words of the hippies and the Bible. God is love. Whoever lives in love lives in God and God in him. Let's undertake the same kind of spiritual analogy with the concepts of art and beauty. Let's say, for example, an alien comes down to Earth and says, "Greetings, Earthlings. We don't have this thing you call art in our culture on our home planet. What is it exactly? Prove to me that art and its resulting beauty, as you know and experience it, exist." Said art-curious alien could then be shown statues and paintings and symphonies and poems and dance performances, but the alien would simply proffer that those were certainly tangible examples of modes of human expression, but that's not what it was explicitly asking for. How does said alien know that a Radiohead concert or a Monet painting or a Shakespearean sonnet or a Brazilian capoeira demonstration is moving and beautiful? When does mere expression attain the station, status, or transcendence of art? Can we ever point directly to what comprises the artness of certain music, words on a page, movement on a stage, or filmed stories on a screen? Where is proof that said artistic works truly rise above humdrum reality and move emotions and perspectives in a radiant demonstration of elevated aesthetic pleasure? Where is the repeatable experiment that irrefutably proves that said works reveal the human condition, are verifiably beautiful, and quantifiably provoke longing, compassion, and sublime as great works of art and beauty supposedly do? For most of us, defining art is similar to Supreme Court Justice Stewart's famous refrain about porn. When asked what makes something that contains nudity porn or not, he famously said, "I know it when I see it." The inability to prove art or love or beauty does not mean that those concepts don't exist. They may be on a higher plane of human perception, but are just as real as a toaster oven or a shrimp burrito. I accept your judgment, judicious reader, comparing proof of the existence of God to proof of the existence of love, art, beauty, goodness, and truth might be a bit of a stretch. But is it any more of a stretch than considering a God that compares in some fashion to an omniscient superhero in the sky, wanting proof of a being or entity that exists somewhere, that looks down on us from above, that judges us nonstop and tabulates naughty and nice? The scholar David Bentley Hart points out that what most atheists describe when they talk about God is an above-mentioned demiurge, a being among other beings. Only this particular demiurge being is a kind of deity who fashioned the physical world and meddles in the affairs of the denizens it created. Couldn't God, in fact, be far more comparable to a concept than a being? Hart speaks of thinking of the divine as less of a being than of being itself. Just as we have a little bobbing 3D movie of our consciousness in our heads as we trundle about our lives, couldn't God be conceived of as the consciousness of the universe itself? God as nature, as science, as light, as pi? Scientists do backflips trying to find a unified theory of everything, a hypothesis that connect all of physics, from gravity and general relativity to quantum physics and electromagnetics, from the subatomic principles to the very limits of astrophysics and the Big Bang itself. And if you've ever tried to take a peek into string theory or M theory and their preposterously countless dimensions of reality and hyperspace, one comes back to Occam's razor. Sometimes the simplest explanation is perhaps the best one. In this case, isn't it simpler to infer that a creator spirit explains the underlying unity in all things? The Nobel Prize-winning physicist Max Planck put it this way: all matter originates and exists only by virtue of a force. We must assume behind this force the existence of a conscious and intelligent mind. As I write this, I realize that attempting to define the undefinable, especially with a limited resource of mere language as our toolkit, is somewhat a fool's errand. How can one use a tool as deficient as language to attempt to express the inexpressible? Language is merely the flitting of the shadows on the wall of Plato's cave in the grand scheme of things, a finger pointing at the moon. But nonetheless, we forge on. I was speaking to Dr. Varun Soni, chaplain at the University of Southern California, and he had an outrageous comparison for God that truly made me chuckle. He suggested that perhaps we should think of God as being like the Internet. What precisely is the Internet? Can you point your finger at it? Is it circuits, servers, websites? No, it's so much more. It's a plane of being unto itself. Think Tron. Think The Matrix. It's beautiful and horrible. It contains love and hate and the beauty of human expression. It's both a tool and a destination. It can be harnessed for good or twisted for evil. It's a world of malignant hackers and imaginative digital artists. It's a world of ones and zeros and also of scintillating pixels, mindless diversion and unifying gorgeous entertainment. But there is power there, running in it, through it, behind it, a microcosm and shadow of our physical universe. To extrapolate on this absurd metaphor, Wi-Fi is then analogous to the Holy Spirit, and our individual computers, Macs or PCs, are our souls. All interconnected. And these laptop souls of ours can be trained and harnessed for either good or evil. They are tools that can be used for writing beautiful poetry or distributing paranoid lies on Facebook. Again, Dr. Soni is not saying that God is specifically like the Internet, but he is simply drawing another analogy that allows us to shift perspective away from anything remotely demiurgic or anthropomorphized. Abdu'l-Bahá writes, People have pictured a god in the realm of the mind and worship that image which they have made for themselves. Consider, then, how all the peoples of the world are bowing the knee to a fancy of their own contriving, how they have created a creator within their own minds, and they call it the fashioner of all that is. The essence of essences, that invisible of invisibles, exists above all human speculation, never to be overtaken or fully comprehended by the mind of man. This concept exists in every culture and faith tradition. The Tao that can be told is not the eternal Tao. The name that can be named is not the eternal name. The unnameable is the eternally real. Free from desire, you realize the mystery. Tao Te Ching. In the fourth gospel, Jesus prays that they may all be one, as thou, Father, art one in me and I in you, that they may be one in us. Zeno, great name, the founder of Stoicism, said beautifully, God is not separate from the world. He is the soul of the world, and each of us contains a part of the divine fire. All things are part of one single system, which is called nature. Soul of the world. I just love that. Western thought has been maniacally focused on God as the source of creation, a founder, an instigator. There have been countless debates, discussions, and philosophical treatises in this vein. My friend, the great Baha'i philosopher and PhD in physics from Princeton, Stephen Phelps, reminded me that the discussion has unfortunately been far less focused on God as a goal, a destination, a way of life, a rich garden of qualities to emulate, or an energy to both draw from and align with. Perhaps we ought to spend less time thinking of this creative force as a what, and more like a how. How to live in this world with radiance, humility, a spirit of service, and a sacred harmony. A God that emanates divine qualities in the same way that pesky spiritual metaphor in the sky, the sun, emanates light, heat, and healing. Perhaps God could not even be considered as something distinct or separate from what he has fashioned, but rather as the sum of creation. The 15th century philosopher Nicholas of Cusa had an indelible and unforgettable way of framing the conception of the Creator. He once said, divinity is in all things in such a way that all things are in divinity. He spoke of a God whose center, so to speak, is everywhere and whose circumference is nowhere. Kind of like Wakan Tanka. And we come now to the end of this week's program, and we'll continue with Rain's book in the coming weeks. As always, I wish you a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week, and I look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher program.